The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, predicting the future can be a very dangerous business because today you see predictions of the future oscillating between the most wild and unbelievable pessimistic statements of doomsday to the most wild and unbelievable optimistic statements of near utopia ahead. Recently, a group of futurists were meeting in Washington, D.C., and I was there for the first of those futurist conferences and listened to some of the speeches being made, saw some of the various seminars, the meetings, the motion pictures, the displays, the councils, the conferences, all the various proposals from dried foods to various new methods of heating. But you know, they claimed the apostles of doom were all wrong. That not only would the world survive on past the year 2000, but it would survive in a very wonderful way and be prospering. Now, I can't help but looking a little bit at the pessimistic side, having just returned from a trip to Europe, and at the same time having just read an unbelievable article in the National Geographic on the subject of the starvation and the famine in Bangladesh, which is only a microcosm of much of the rest of all of Asia, of much of Central and South America, of a tremendous slice of Africa, especially the Sub-Sahara, where starvation, burgeoning populations, and unbelievable malnutrition of the people is a constant day-to-day way of life. But according to some of the futurologists there in Washington, D.C., the world will not only survive in the year 2000, but it will prosper. They say that population is stabilized, that energy and food supplies are abundant, and they talked about the average American now earning $25,000 a year. They talked about how poverty rolls had dwindled. And there were many, many reassuring views that were advanced. These were people and heads of institutions who should know and who don't seem to know exactly what the future holds. As a matter of fact, maybe it was the president for the Institute of the Future from Menlo Park, California, Roy C. Amara, who said, and I certainly agree with his statement, quote, "We can't predict what is going to happen in 10 or 15 days, let alone 10 or 15 years. But what we can do in exchanging views like this is to get a better feel of what we want to happen and what we don't want to happen." One thing we don't want to happen in this world is the proliferation of nuclear weapons. We have overkill, they argue, whether it's 50 times, 30, 20, and I've said even once would be enough. Overkill meaning the power to obliterate human life over and over and over again. That is already in existence. But now there is a new arms race feared directly as a result of a West German deal with Brazil. The West Germans have agreed to build a nuclear power system in Brazil. And you know, a number of other Latin American capitals are a little excited about it, and so are some of the people in the U.S. State Department. Now, maybe the entire language of the agreement isn't quite clear to Western planners, but enough is known to cause a lot of excitement in certain major circles, not only in Latin America, but in the United States. It has to do with the West Germans building nuclear reactors inside Brazil, providing with a complete fuel cycle system, and believed to be the first sale yet of a complete nuclear system to a non-nuclear power. I want to remind you of World War II briefly, just as a thought to stick in here in the midst of all this discussion. During World War II, Brazil was called a dollar colony by Juan Perón, who was then the dictator of Argentina. But after World War II, many top Nazis, including sub-echelon and middle-echelon Nazis, officials, burgermeisters, leaders in civil services, the military, escaped to many countries in Central and South America. Now, that's well known. You can go to the local bookstore right now and buy books, if you like, about the names of some of these people. I mean, Eichmann really existed. He really was apprehended and was spirited away by Israeli agents and was brought to trial in Israel. But for each of the Eichmanns brought to trial, there are dozens or perhaps hundreds of little-known, perhaps lower-echelon Nazi officials living inside some of the South American countries. principally Argentina, Chile, Peru, Bolivia, Uruguay under Stroessner's military dictatorship, but also in Brazil. When I was in Sao Paulo a few years back, I was amazed to see separate German publications, why they have German schools, large German colonies in many of those leading cities down there. And I went to the new Krupp Works and reported on that for the Plain Truth, not too far a drive outside the city, where the Krupp family, the arms builders of Germany, were building a big steel mill just outside the city of Sao Paulo, Brazil. So there's a great deal of trade, but the point is, Nazism is not dead. There are the neo-Nazis, even though the pride of a lot of seats inside the German parliament. Nevertheless, the spirit of rightism, of ultra-reaction to problems which would come along to upset the present apple cart in West Germany are very real, are alive. Nevertheless, behind the scenes, underground, little seen or realized by the Western world, they are there. As Brian Connell, the editor of Watcher Along the Rhine, as his title may have been some years ago, a Reuters correspondent for about 20 years and a personal friend of George Adenauer, the son of the D'Alta, as he was called, the former chancellor some years back of West Germany. And this gentleman knew exactly what was going on underground, behind the scenes, inside West Germany. He knew that out of the top 15 multimillionaire Ruhr industrialists, 14 were former card-carrying Nazis. He knew the entire political system, that the political parties exist on subvention from the major industrialists. He knew the entire system was different from that in the United States, and that democracy is nevertheless an experiment inside West Germany. And his warning, voiced so many years ago, was, if anything comes along to disturb the equilibrium of newfound prosperity, meaning runaway inflation, deep recession, possible depression, then he said, look out. Because he knew the call inside West Germany would be for a strong man. I had occasion to talk to a person who had spent 11 years in Berlin recently. And you know, it's amazing. Only when you talk to Americans who have lived there for years can you seem to listen, coming right back out of other people's mouths, exactly what I've been saying on this broadcast for about 20 solid years. It is only people who have been there, maybe military men or their dependents, people who have lived there, who have seen it, who have felt it, who have understood that democracy is still an experiment inside West Germany, that they want to help alarm, lift up a voice of warning, somehow alert and awaken Americans to the real dangers that exist. Now, when I was at the Paris Air Show and took pictures of the Alpha jet and trying once again to tell Americans, look, we somehow like to think of docile, humble Germany, a complete new generation of people who never even heard of Adolf Hitler, a complete, regenerated, humanized, repentant, wonderful nation of people who have every reason to have nothing but love and trust and the best feelings for the United States. And let me tell you, that is a nursery rhyme. It's a child's dream. It is not true. Those who have had to live inside West Germany and have had to deal with the civilian populace as a dependent of a military base, and even they have been terribly shielded, and so have employees of some major American firms, because they tend to gather together in their own little cloistered areas, and they tend to have friends, and they tend to visit and to shop and to work among themselves. And they do so almost by nature because of a recoiling from the West German society. Wasn't it the former president of France, Charles de Gaulle, who talked about knights bearing garlands and belching beer, who tried in poetic language to put to words the present German society? But now, when I try to tell people, look, they have been building supersonic fighter bombers inside West Germany for years, their mouths drop open, they say, you've got to be kidding. No, I'm not kidding. It's been in the newspapers, it's been in the magazines, it's known. It's a matter of license. The old companies of Messerschmitt, of Dornier, are still in business. When I go to the Paris Air Show and see a supersonic jet fighter built by Dornier of West Germany, with a big iron cross on its side, with all the armaments laid out in front, take pictures of it, describe it, talk about it, It's almost like you're still telling something that is absolutely not true because the American public doesn't want to believe it. They don't want to believe that the Germans have a very strong defense force. They don't want to believe there are more than 100 separate locations inside West Germany where American nuclear weapons are stored, strategic as well as tactical. And that fully half or more of the American nuclear capacity is inside Europe, and about 90% of that amount is stored inside West Germany. Now, when I see the West Germans building nuclear reactors for non-nuclear nations, I would have a little bit of reason to be alarmed about it myself. These are things we don't want to happen, but the futurists dream on about a coming utopia while the world arms. Let me catch you up to date briefly on just what is happening in nuclear arms. The West German reactor being built for Brazil would give them a full fuel cycle system, believed to be the first of its kind, to be sold. Conversion of such a system to the construction of nuclear weapons, by the way, is terribly easy, and that's what is disturbing Washington, D.C. The United States is trying to see if the governments of both West Germany and Brazil wouldn't be willing to write all kinds of safeguards for inspection into this system and into the agreements by which the system will be built and delivered. But Brazil doesn't like those suggestions, thinking that that's an infringement upon its own sovereignty. Some other nation sticking its nose into Brazil's business, telling it how to run its affairs when it has no right to do so. The purchase of this West German system is obviously seen by those who are really thinking about the ramifications of it all as a little part of a present Brazilian military government idea for rapid growth of Brazil, for development of Brazil, for the opening up of the Mato Grosso, the whole idea of making Brazil the biggest, most powerful nation in South America, the United States of South America, virtually. Now, in that connection, there's a pact not only involving these problems of proliferation of nuclear weapons, at least the potential for them, but maybe you didn't hear about enormous deals involving some of the major German firms, such as Volkswagen, going into things other than just building automobiles, or Krupp going into things other than steel and iron and so on, but large cattle deals, huge land deals inside South America. Oh, there's a tremendous amount of investment. Maybe you didn't know that Argentina already has a nuclear reactor system in operation near Buenos Aires, and a couple more are under construction, and they are being built by West Germans. Now, they're less sophisticated than the envisioned plant to be built in Brazil, but they are nevertheless nuclear reactors. And so each South American nation, seeing this happening, a great deal of publicity there, will of course say, we must get one. We can't lag behind in the development of alternative nuclear energy sources for the energy crisis. We've got all kinds of peaceful intentions, all kinds of peaceful reasons to build nuclear reactors. But of course, behind the scenes and in the backs of the minds of leaders is the idea, someday, when we explode our own nuclear device, we will be very careful, like India was, to call not a bomb, but a nuclear device. Well, you know, I say if the dumb thing blows up, it's a bomb. But each one of these governments is not going to be ignorant of the fact that the possession of a nuclear device, which will explode, is very impressive to all of its neighbors. No doubt. That's why an editorial in the Buenos Aires paper recently said we must forge ahead similarly, as Brazil is doing in this nuclear area. So throughout Latin America, all of a sudden, there's a growing interest in acquiring nuclear power plants. There was a Canadian trade mission that went to Cuba recently, as a matter of fact, to discuss the possibility of constructing such a facility for the government of Prime Minister Fidel Castro. You know, all of the countries that have nuclear capability down there, that is, they have the raw materials to make the construction of reactors a possibility. And they're looking into it. You know who they are? Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Mexico, and Venezuela. And because of petrodollars, Venezuela has recently received a tremendous bonus in the form of an avalanche of money and is busily using that money for all kinds of frantic development. Don't think for one moment she won't think about nuclear reactors. But probably right now, Argentina and Brazil are the best prepared for the construction of these reactors, so both of them have bountiful sources of uranium, and they're being given the technical help. Now, from Washington early in June, it was said that there was a great deal of fear and worry about Brazil being on the verge of getting from West Germany the equipment and technical information needed to produce nuclear weapons. The agreement being completed bilaterally between those two nations, which officials said would probably be announced at any time, would be specifically designed to give Brazil the ability to use its vast uranium deposit for producing electricity. Isn't that nice? But the official said the agreement would also give Brazil the, what they call, full nuclear power cycle, which would make it at least theoretically possible for the largest nation in South America to join the nuclear weapons club. You can bet it's going to happen. I've been saying for years on this program, there are 40 nations standing in the wings waiting to join the nuclear club. And I have asked time and again, what is it going to be like with nuclear bombs in the hands of such warring neighbors as North and South Korea, as Israel and the Arab neighbors, as India and Bangladesh? And you could even ask the same question about many Central and South American countries, or about some banana republics, as they're called, and the United States, or about Mexico and the United States, or Cuba and the United States. What kind of a world will it be, and how do you understand the words of futurists, of optimists, who say cornucopia, utopia, peace and plenty, $25,000 a year for the average American? But how does the ad shape up about planning your retirement, the ad about recreation and about villas and villages and golf and nice verdant pasture scenes and little lakes and sailing boats and maybe shuffleboard and bridge with the club when you're 65? How's that stack up with starvation of tens of millions in the sub-Sahara, Bangladesh, India, Asia, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the growth of drought and famine and natural cataclysm? You know, somehow, those who like to prognosticate the future always fall a little short. It seems we're smitten with the idea it's got to be one extreme or the other. Total doomsday, or bountiful utopia. Neither is true, not in the immediate future. I have been accused in a speech widely circulated, made by somebody whose name I've forgotten, of saying the world was going to come to an end. And then the guy promptly, after building up this straw man, proceeds to whip it to death, cut it into bits, and stomp it into the ground, that the world isn't coming to an end. And I couldn't agree with him more. In the first place, he totally misquoted me in the opening statement, saying that he had heard me say that doomsday was coming. I've never said anything of the kind. I've been trying to point out to people time and time again that the good news that was brought to this earth nearly 2,000 years ago of a coming world-ruling government was brought by a person. While the phonetic sound of his name is known by the millions and the tens of millions, his personality, what he looked like, what he came to accomplish, exactly what he said, and the message he brought, is virtually unknown. That's why I've begun this new series of programs on the subject of the Gospels. Because the word gospel, which I've taken at least a couple of three programs to extemporize on, to tell people they don't even know the meaning of the word. And the minute I say that, you're going to wonder, what in the world is he doing shifting gears from nuclear proliferation, from the problem of many nations joining the nuclear club, and from an arms race to the gospel? What in the world has the one got to do with the other? And that's the whole point. Everything. Because Jesus Christ of Nazareth came with the good news of the fact that the world will survive a nuclear holocaust. He didn't say the nuclear holocaust is not coming. He said, except for the elect's sake, there would no flesh be saved. But he made an exception. He said, it's a good thing that there is a purpose, a program, and there are a group of people called the elect on this earth doing the work of that God, or he said there wouldn't be a man, woman, or child left alive on the face of the earth. No, I have not said that doomsday is coming. But I have said a virtual Armageddon of nuclear bomb warfare is coming. It doesn't have to, but you tell me where you see anything being done to prevent it. Nuclear power plant construction is booming all around the world. The arms race is being piled up atop one other kind of arms race on top of another one everywhere you look around the world. The United States, on the one hand, is calling for non-proliferation treaties. And it's entering into SALT talks and the new SALT II talks, trying for strategic arms limitation. On the one hand, we say, we'll halt the building of MIRVs and let the Soviets catch up. If they will halt the building of the giant booster rockets and let us catch up. What kind of an arms limitation is that? But we seem to be satisfied with that. And in the meantime, as all these so-called peaceful nuclear reactors are built, they pile up prodigious amounts of nuclear fuels at the nuclear power plant, and those are terribly dangerous radioactive waste. In the meantime, the futurists say we're going to have bountiful utopia. No, it is not one or the other. It isn't either the wildly optimistic or the gloomily doomsday extreme. It is that both are going to occur. Literally, both are going to occur, and that is the message that Jesus brought. To sum it up, he said in the 24th chapter of Matthew, there will come a time, and he called it an unparalleled, unprecedented time, unlike any in all of history, where he said, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. You can understand the words of Jesus only in the context of a nuclear age. You could never understand it in the context of a World War II conventional warfare prior to the explosion of the atomic bomb, because it was not until the ushering in of the nuclear age that science had given as its final gift, perhaps, to mankind the ability to annihilate himself, but not the ability to control the minds of government leaders, not the ability to control man, to control man's government. So instead, we see a fantastic nuclear arms race, a fantastic conventional arms race. We see old alliances being challenged and threatened, new alliances emerging, neutralism all over Asia and Southeast Asia, the United States foreign policy taking kicks and cuts and bruises around the world with one tiny little momentary respite in the Mayaguez incident. President Ford going to NATO for prepared speeches and few results. And then our own press, of course, tries to show him stumbling down steps instead of standing tall and straight overseas, which I spoke out in the personal column in the Plain Truth recently about, which you can read if you want to write for, by the way, the current number of the Plain Truth, with that article about the NATO summit, Portugal, whether it's going to be Europe's Cuba, the common market influence growing worldwide. But when you look at the overview, as the Plain Truth magazine does, and as the gospel does, the overview of the entirety of the world, you have to see both sides. There is not now any optimistic news that the world has solved the population problem, or the food problem, or the nuclear proliferation problem, or the conventional arms race problem, or even the guns versus butter issue in one nation after another. The giant problems that continue to divide humankind are not being solved. The conference on world population and food at Rome was certainly a case in point, and we covered that from on the spot for the assembled, probably flabby, flatulent, overstuffed, fully fed diplomats gathered around their conference table to discuss the problem of starvation of the world, going out to their fine restaurants in Rome, seated down with their comfortable after-dinner cigar for the afternoon session to talk about starvation. A great deal of verbiage came out of that, including an open forum for attacks against the United States, accused of manufacturing the idea of the population explosion merely to try to get the Asians to curtail population growth because we fear eventually they're going to outpopulate us and therefore get the upper hand. If you can imagine that kind of insensate, stupid, and unbelievable statement. I gave the Jackass Awards at that time, you may recall, for a couple of the people, among them the foreign minister of Algeria, for statements made about the United States, hinting that maybe we would cut off some of the food shipments to some of the Arab states because of their fuel embargo. Well, it's already been proposed time and again, and at least a few members in government have speculated maybe we would be able to retaliate in kind. But then I don't think the United States usually thinks that way, so I don't expect that to happen. But when you look at the incredible overview, there is really nothing being done to solve the huge problems that divide humankind. What supposedly began as a concerted effort by delegates from about 100 nations to devote themselves to the problem of food versus population, growing famine and drought, the starvation of millions of human beings literally dying every year, it degenerated into a name-calling session of using that conference for nothing more than a political platform to sway world public opinion against the United States. How can you expect, then, progress, so long as that is the outcome of such meetings, where you would think the most serious-minded, the most technically qualified, the most intelligent, astute, and wise among all the leadership of the world are gathered together to ponder one of the seemingly imponderables confronting all of humankind today. Instead, they acted like kids in a playground at recess. It's unbelievable, the name-calling, the blame-placing that went on in the Rome Conference on food. But what was really accomplished? How much? Let me just ask you this. I'll tell you how much was accomplished. You tell me how much you remember about it. How much do you remember about it? What is being done? What specific program? Do you know of anything that was actually done? Well, you just answered my question as to how much was accomplished. No, the overview is not that of either the gloom and doom of a coming destruction of all of humankind, nor is it the wildly optimistic of a wonderful cornucopia utopia of everybody with $25,000 income and his private helicopter on the front yard. It is exactly midway in between that. It is a time that your Bible describes in the Gospels, according to Jesus Christ of Nazareth, of a coming time leading toward what the Bible describes as Armageddon, a worldwide nuclear bomb war, which is going to occur unless the nations responsible can get on their knees and submit to God's government in advance and prevent it. And out of that horrible time, a utopia is eventually going to occur. Well, if you want the overview, you need your name on the mailing list of the unique publication, The Plain Truth, that really gives you, from the point of view of Bible prophecy, the true meaning of present world events and world news. And while you're at it, request this book of the United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy. The United States in Prophecy is a book that you'll want to read that tells you our prophetic origins, our identity in the pages of the Bible. Where does the Bible identify the people of Britain, the United States, of Canada, of South Africa, of Australia, of some of the democracies of Northwestern Europe?
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.